Hello, this is Mary from Talking Information Center, reading from the Saturday Evening Post, January-February 2026 issue. The first story, American Pop by Cable Newhouse. GPS is my co-pilot, how we got here and where we're going. As revolutions go, this one began quietly, with a buy rather than a bang. Location, Hunter's Hill, a Sydney suburb so small you'd be hard-pressed to pinpoint it on a map of Australia. Unless you had the right kind of map, which until relatively recently you almost certainly did not. It was there, in the opening days of 2004, that four guys who ran a startup called Where2Tech sold their company to Google, which saw an opportunity. Weeks later, the pioneering technology rebranded as Google Maps was introduced to the public by its new American owners. Within 24 hours, Google Maps had been viewed 10 million times. The satellite navigation revolution was officially underway. It's estimated that today, in the United States, some 230 million of us rely on GPS maps for turn-by-turn guidance to everywhere that's been photographed from a satellite, even if that has seldom seen human visitors. The technology has transformed the way we see our planet, and more importantly, how we see each of us can get our way around it. No more getting hopelessly lost. Before Google Maps, I wandered the earth aimlessly, discovering villages and hamlets untouched by the 20th or 21st centuries. Toothless inhabitants would surround my car in wide-eyed wonder and ask if I fell from outer space. My friend John Oliver, a New York writer, recently posted on Substack. He was exaggerating for impact, I think. The fact of the matter is that most of us would just as soon embark on a journey without some sort of small navigation device as walk out in front of the front door pantless. The big guys in this space include Google Maps, of course, but also Apple Maps, Waze, and TomTom. As navigationally challenged American, I rely on a 4-sat-nav service on my phone and in my car. Each has a particular strength. Details about dining specials along my route, or scenic paths, or just cool on-scene graphics. Some folks claim they've been emotionally attached to the voice they selected for the GPS, spoken directions. Not an issue for me, but a Californian I know told me he's addicted to Chaka Khan, the soothing tones in his in-car system. Relax your mind, turn left, we're going to get there, I freaking love her, he said. It's no surprise that most car buyers in 2026 say they won't even consider a model unless it has a wireless sat-nav system, such as CarPlay, onboard, GPS guidance. It's no longer merely a convenience. Today, it's central to a lifestyle that demands our total surrender to ever-expanding embrace of microchips. Even so, there remains a subset of folks who refuse to crumple up their old paper maps. Some of those were indeed things of beauty and, in other era, trusted companions. AAA iconic Triptych finally went digital a while ago. But those spiral-bound and once indispensable Thomas guides on the West Coast still serve something for those hangers-on. What's the downside of satellite navigation? Well, for one, imagine what would happen if the system suddenly collapsed, even for just a few days. The technology is responsible for billions of dollars of economic benefit to the country due to the logistical efficiencies it's enabled. Without it, the super swift deliveries we've grown to accustomed to could not happen. Imagine, if you will, no Amazon. Next up, universal navigation of indoor spaces. It's a work in progress. Give it about 5 years, experts say. In the last issue, Cable Newhouse wrote about baseball caps as personal statements. Next is titled Lighter Side by Philip Gully. Sick of being well, a hypochondriac makes the most of Medicare. This February, I'll be turning 65 and going on Medicare. provided we still have a functioning government. If we don't, I'll be cooking up some rheumatiz medicine, like Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies, to cure what ails me. If that doesn't work, my plan C is to avoid illness altogether, which won't be easy because I've been a robust hypochondriac since infancy, concocting all manners of maladies, diseases, poxes, and conditions. On July 2nd, 1970, our barn thermometer read 99 degrees Fahrenheit. I was so hot I convinced myself I was entering menopause, which was impossible since I was only 9 years old and hadn't yet ovulated. But determined hypochondriac isn't deterred by trivialities like age and gender. If all goes as planned and I enroll in Medicare, I'll be able to see a doctor the next to nothing. Having never enjoyed this luxury, I plan on being sick as much as possible. New retirees are advised to find a hobby, and mine will be spending hours each day in the doctor's offices, being tested, poked, and probed. If I'm lucky, they'll find a new disease, so I'll have something to talk about. I hope it's so exotic no one else can top it. I have type 2 diabetes, but so does everyone else. As diseases go, type 2 diabetes is a snoozer. A friend of mine went to Africa where he was fortunate enough to contract monkeypox, making him the hit of every party. I don't even like him anymore. I would start talking about my diabetes and he would mention his monkeypox, show off his blisters, and dominate the conversation. Much to his chagrin, the monkeypox went away and he went back to being his old boring self, suffering the occasional head cold, which served him right. For the past several years, I've been under the care of a nurse practitioner named Laura at a wellness clinic sponsored by my wife's employer. I was excited at first, thinking Laura might be naive because of her youth and inexperience. Unfortunately, she turned out to be one of the scientific types and didn't believe me this past summer when I told her I had a rare type of COVID. In all probability, fatal. I asked her to write my wife a note explaining my imminent death requiring a month's rest in our greenhouse. But being cynical sort, she insisted on testing me and told me my COVID was allergies. It's clear she can't be trusted. When I told her I would be going on Medicare, she said she couldn't see me anymore and that I would have to return to my previous doctor, who's older than I am. Of all the doctors I've ever had, he's been my favorite. He agrees with me that I am the sickest person he's ever met. The most serious illness of my 65 years has been the Spanish flu, which certain discredited doctors claimed petered out in 1920, though I swear I had it in 1978. I had a sore throat, a headache, a dry cough, which everyone knows can only be one thing, the Spanish flu. And here's the weird thing. I don't even speak Spanish, even though I took 2 years of it in high school. Señorita Rogers was our teacher and had spent the summer before in Spain, so I caught it from her. We still live in the same town, so whenever I see her, I remind her that she almost killed me 48 years ago. But she just laughs and says I'm crazy, which is exactly what Laura, the nurse practitioner, has been telling me. Phil Bacgully is a Quaker pastor and author of 22 books, including the Harmony and Hope series featuring Sam Gardner. Next is titled In My Life by Rachel Dickinson. A difficult person to live with. The secret to our long-lasting marriage is space. I admit that I'm not the easiest person to live with. I really need time, a lot of time alone. I like to travel, and I'm often heading out of the house with a carry-on bag in search of either a story or a self-imposed retreat. And when I'm in the house, I tend to sit in my chair by the fireplace with a tray in front of me that holds either an easel or a laptop. 10 feet away is a television, invariably playing some bad, but definitely not good, episodic show, which serves as my work soundtrack. Today, when I step back and review how I conduct my life, even I can see that it might be difficult to fit another person into this solitary routine. My husband, Tim, is like me in many ways. He loves to travel and is also a writer who likes to work in a space that is carved out for himself in the house. Until about 5 years ago, Tim went to work in an office every day, so we had very separate workspaces that, I suspect, made us both happy. I warned him that when he retired, he would never discover that I spent an awful lot of time sitting in the living room with a television on and that he didn't have to work around that, because he is a pleasant and more accommodating person than me. Tim said, no problem, and figured it out. We would love to travel together, but we have two dogs, one peregrine, a gecko, two fish, a snail, and during the first 25 years of marriage, we also had kids at home. The gecko and fish tank were left behind by one daughter who moved across country for a job, and one of the dogs were given to us by another daughter who moved to Serbia for 4 years. But the two problematic creatures are not the ones that were left with us. We also have a goofy English setter that I can't walk on a leash because she is prone to dragging me around, and in one unfortunate moment last autumn, broke my wrist. The other is the peregrine, Falcon, whom I can't do anything with except provide food because I'm not a licensed falconer. And neither of these creatures can be taken into a kennel or left with another person. I think the tag team form of travel over the decades has worked for us because although we'd love to visit the Louvre or the Met together, we can still look at each other and say, well, we'll always have Paris, just not at the same time. This goes for Ireland, Iceland, Italy, Scotland, and Western Canada as well, places we both loved and have visited multiple times, but never with each other. As our kids frequently point out to me, particularly when I ask them for favors, you need to be more direct. Ask for what you want, use your words. I don't know if they say the same to their father, although I don't think he ever asks them for anything. I try to explain to the girls that being raised by an extremely passive-aggressive mother who always approached favor by engaging a flanking maneuver was how I learned my awesome communication techniques. Wow, my mother would say, to no one in particular, a cup of coffee would taste really good now. Or, don't you think that chair would be better over there, pointed to the opposite side of the living room? Or, when looking at a toddler lurching around her house, she would break that, wouldn't she? Or she won't. As the toddler reaches for a cut glass butter dish, the coffee would be made, the chair moved, and the cut glass butter dish taken from the toddler's hands. I think the case I'm trying to make is that my husband and I are seriously attached, metaphorically, at the hip. I am not going to get into the nitty-gritty of an attachment theory and how it relates to unsuccessful long-term marriages, but suffice to say that Tim and I are too much alike in some basic ways to have a successful long-term marriage, and yet here we are, married for 34 years. A piece in Psychology Today about marriage states marriage does more than change people's living situation and daily routine. Becoming a spouse appears to change one's personality as well, especially in the early years of marriage. Men, for example, tend to become more conscientious and introverted than they were when they were single, and women more emotionally stable, but both tend to become less agreeable. Aha, so that last line explains it. Enough of my crankiness has rubbed off on Tim to keep him in a kind of status, to keep us in a place where we're both navigate the world and each other indirectly. However, I still believe that sometimes, if I think about something long enough, Tim will read my mind through Vulcan method, an ultimate passive-aggressive move. Rachel Dixon is the author of several books, her most recent, The Loneliest Place, Lost Grief, and The Long Journey Home. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, including The Atlantic, Outside Men's Journal, Aeon, Salon, and Audubon. Next is the Post-it section. Diana Ross, Music, Listen Again, The Oldies Are Still the Goodies, by Diana Ross. Self-titling album several years into a storied career makes a statement. When you release the second self-titled album in your storied career, you really mean it. For Diana Ross, who broke out as the lead voice of the Supremes and went on to solo stardom, her second record began a career highlight. Diana Ross contains two diametrically opposite chart toppers. Theme from Mahogany, Do You Know Where You're Going To, and Love Hangover. The first was on the title track of the Ross starring film. The song was much bigger than the film, hitting number one on the charts and earning a spot on the American Film Institute's venerable list of 100 movie songs. But the real gem on the album is Love Hangover, clocking at 7 minutes 48 seconds. The song slowly builds from a ballad into a dance floor stormer. At the 2.42 mark, Ross and company dramatically shift the tempo, and Henry E. Davis drops one of the funkiest bass lines of an extremely funky decade. The two songs are emblematic of Ross's range and growth from her early 60s debut, morphing from girl group leader to torch songstress to disco diva. With ridiculous ease, Ross reminds us why she was one of the greatest stars of multiple musical eras. What's on Seriously Good Film and TV? Film critic Bill Newcott offers his entertainment picks for mature audiences. Ella McKay, December 12th. It has been 15 years since director James L. Brooks, the man behind Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News, stepped behind the camera. And that reason is enough for him to celebrate this warm comedy starring Emma McKay. Barbie, as an idealistic politician whose sudden success endangers her relationships with her quirky family. Brooks says he sees the film as a throwback to a great screwball comedy of the 40s. His all-star lineup includes longtime pals Albert Brooks, Broadcast News, and Julie Kavner, The Simpsons, plus the always wonderful Jamie Lee Curtis, Woody Harrelson, and Rebecca Hall. Is This Thing On, December 19th? Few funny people explore the melancholy that feeds comedy more agreeably than Will Arnett, whose frustrated magician, Gob Bluth, on TV's Arrest Development, was driven by a desperate and hilariously doomed hunger for approval. Arnett co-wrote this comic drama about Alex, a depressed New York guy trying to deal with his pending divorce by passing through the brick-walled crucible of stand-up comedy. Laura Dern co-stars as his compassionate wife. Bradley Cooper, who directs the film with a handheld look and a great big heart, pops up as Alex's ever-smiling stoner friend. No Other Choice, December 25th. The oddest imaginable choice for a Christmas Day opening. This pitch-black comedy from Korean director Park Chan-wook, Old Boy, is nevertheless a gift to film lovers who don't mind squirming in their seats. The story involves a mid-level executive, Squid Games, Lee Bi-hoon, who faced with either unemployment or a big promotion, sets about trying to murder the only men in Korea who are more qualified for the job than he is. Audiences at the Toronto International Film Festival didn't know whether to moan in dismay or laugh out loud. In one sense, Park wouldn't have had it any other way. Maybe wait for the holiday lights to come down before catching this one, then make a New Year's resolution to consider the curse of untamed ambition. Next section is books, what we're reading. When they're not bringing you stories from around the nation, the editors at the Post are always reading. Here's some of the books they're enjoying this season. Overtaken by Elizabeth Oliver. If you prefer your romance heroines, relatable, witty, and even a bit gritty, literally, then Cam Wexford is your gal. A mechanic for an IndyCar racing team, Cam is the only woman working in the often enraging boys club of Environment of Gasoline Alley. The big news in the garage is that a new driver will be joining the racing team, Loic Chalmeau, a former Formula One superstar with a reputation for cool arrogance. He and Cam have crossed paths before under unfortunate circumstances, and Cam wants to avoid him at all costs. Of course, fate has other plans. Against the heart-pounding background of IndyCar racing and cast for entertaining supporting characters, the author peels back layers to reveal why Cam is so set on avoiding Loic. Loic's motivations for leaving F1 and what it takes to succeed in racing and in romance. The Constant Rabbit by Jasper Ford. On the night of August 12, 1965, 18 rabbits grew to roughly human-sized proportions in what became known as the spontaneous anthropomorphic event. Their size wasn't the problem. It was their newfound intellect, self-awareness, and ability to speak, all qualities that once belonged to only humanity. At first, the new sapient species was welcomed, and the rabbits were treated well. But then in modern times, leupomorphic extremist organizations like the UK Anti-Rabbit Party and Two Legs Good have risen to places of power. Beatrix Potter meets George Orwell in this whimsical yet biting satire of our current political and social climate. As an officer in the Rabbit Compliance Task Force, must come to terms with his role in the government of peaceful population. It's the cutest dystopia you'll ever meet. Everything is Tuberculosis by John Green. Tuberculosis is not only treatable, but curable. How then does it remain the world's deadliest infectious disease? This is the question that spurred the fault in our star's author's obsession with TB. What he argues is that why tuberculosis may be the medical cause of TB, healthcare inequities created by human choices are ultimately what allow this disease of poverty to continue to infect the planet. While TB is a worldwide problem, at the heart of this book are stories of individuals, real people, with real problems. Yes, those stories tell us of unnecessary pain, suffering, and death, but they're not without humor. And Green's outlook is fundamentally hopeful. A solution is available. We simply must choose to use it. Asked the vet, distempered. Question. Our dogs killed a raccoon that had distemper. Is raccoon distemper transmittable to dogs? What about humans? Answer. Distemper is widespread in the raccoon population. The disease is caused by the canine distemper virus, CDV. It can spread from raccoons to dogs. Fortunately, the canine distemper vaccination is very effective, so your dogs are protected if their distemper vaccination are current. Humans do not get distemper. However, CDV is highly contagious to many carnivores, including dogs, ferrets, cats, raccoons, coyotes, and others. The virus impacts the entire body, so infected animals display a variety of clinical signs. The disease usually begins with lethargy, loss of appetite, fever, coughing, and discharge from the nose and eyes. Infected dogs spread CDV through bodily fluids. Most virus is shed through the first 2 weeks after illness, though viral shedding can continue for up to 3 months. Fortunately, CDV is susceptible to many disinfectants. Ask the Vet is written by veterinarian Lee Pickett, VMD. Send questions to editors at SaturdayEveningPost.com and read more at SaturdayEveningPost.com/AskTheVet. The next section is titled The Grid, Time and Time Again. Absolutely fabulous. Courts in ancient Athens used dripping water timers called clepsydra to limit speech length. Published in 1895, H.G. Wells, The Time Machine, sent a Victorian scientist to the year 800,002-701. Likely the first issue of time travel in fiction, 1733's Memoirs of the 20th Century features diplomat dispatches written in the 1990s. As late as the mid-1900s, some workers paid knocker-uppers to wake them up in the morning so they wouldn't be late for work. From 1794 to 1800, France adopted decimal time, which divided the day into 10 hours, the hour into 10 minutes, etc. Rude awakening. In 1919, John D. Humphrey patented an alarm clock that slapped its owner awake. Madeline L'Engle's Wrinkle in Time won the 1963 Newbery Medal. The first issue of Time magazine was published in March 1923, with retiring House Speaker Joseph Cannon on the cover. Family Ties. The 2002 movie, The Time Machine, was directed by Simon Wells, the great-grandson of H.G. Wells. The Chronovisor. The device that lets users see into the past was purportedly created in the 1950s and is hidden in a secret Vatican vault. Take a day off. American Samoa skipped over December 30th, 2011, as they switch sides of the international dateline. A one-of-a-kind Patek Philippe wristwatch sold for $31 million in a 2019 auction. Next is titled Superstar Kids, Making a House into a Hive. Some people run from bees, but 13-year-old Oliver Taylor welcomes them into his home. He's built a beehive that you can actually keep in your house. Oliver grew up with an interesting building, and his creations have been viewed millions of times online. His indoor beehive was inspired by other designs, but Oliver created his own 3D printing parts and added a tunnel that allows the bees to come and go without escaping into the Taylor family home. Oliver also created a bed that shakes when your alarm goes off to get you moving in the morning. And for all the people who joke about building a catapult, Oliver did it. He says it started out just 5 feet tall, but then I upgraded to 10 feet tall because I wanted to send a watermelon to our ducks. Maybe Oliver just reinvented food delivery, too. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Mary reading from Talking Information Center from the Saturday Evening Post, January-February 2026 issue. Thank you for listening.